This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Here's a quote, and it's a little bit of a frightening one, from Heather Gerken's book, The Democracy Index. The best evidence we have suggests that our election system is clunky at worst and dysfunctional at best. Ballots are discarded, poll workers are poorly trained, registration lists work badly, lines can be too long, machines malfunction, and partisan officials change the rules of the game to help themselves and hurt their enemies. So what do you do? How do you create a system that works better? Heather Gerken, a law professor at Yale, has an innovative answer, an idea she calls the Democracy Index. Heather Gerken, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Let's go back to that election night in 2000. I'm going to play a little bit of NBC's coverage of the election. First, you're going to hear Gore campaign manager Terry McAuliffe, and then you're going to hear Tom Brokaw sort of throwing up his hands and saying, I don't know what to do here. Let's listen.
These people have worked their heart out to make sure that Al Gore is the next president of the United States, and we want to make sure that all those votes are counted, because at the end of the day, we know that when they're all counted, Al Gore will be president of the United States of America.
It's just far too confusing. We're about to make an official call. It's just too confusing. Ford has been in play all night long. It has not been a sterling evening for vote projections in that state. Originally, NBC News and all the other networks projected that Al Gore would win Florida. Then at 2:18 this morning, we project. All right, we're officially saying that Florida is too close to call because of a recall. Campaign and voter counters are being called back to work to count absentee ballots. Will that be going on throughout the evening, so far as we know?
Heather Gerken from Yale. I mean, that of course, was the first night. That was only the beginning of that situation. What was going on there in Florida?
One of the things about studying the election system is you realize that very little of it has to do with human malice. So at the very top, there are certainly partisan officials who are making calls and roughing the game as they play it. And as a result, you know, they'll do what they can to favor their own party and hurt the other. But for the poor election administrators who are running these things on a day-to-day basis, they are completely understaffed, completely under-resourced, trying to do a giant project without adequate resources to do it. So for them, you know, it's almost always that they just happen to be the victim of a turnout tsunami. That's what happened in Florida in 2000. That's what happened in Ohio in 2004. I mean, one of the things I remember about Ohio in 2004 is that we all thought we'd be up for another long night. It just turns out that the margin in Ohio a victory was bigger than the margin of error. But, you know, every time we run an election where it's close, we risk having a problem like we did in Florida, because there are enough problems in the system that if it's too close to call, it may be that those problems actually affect the outcome.
And here we are in the midst of what could be a really, really hotly contested 50-50 kind of presidential election. And you say in the book, Cuyahoga County, Ohio, has some real problems. I think you actually quote somebody from Cuyahoga County who says, I really, really hope that the next election does not rest on Cuyahoga County. We have too many problems for that.
Yes, I think he said, God help us if the next presidential election turns on Cuyahoga County.
Yeah.
And I think the rest of us all immediately said, amen. You know, they're just, it's not, I don't want to pick on Cuyahoga County in particular. I mean, one of the things that you learn about the election system is that there are a lot of places that are extremely well run, and there are a lot of places that are not. And the key is when the elections are close and the margins are close, you get to see which is which.
So, all right, so let's sort of try to zero in on what some of those problems are. I heard Charlie Cook, the author of the Cook Political Report and great vote counter in the country, and he was talking, oh, just in the last week or two, and saying, look, 99% of the error is just human error. We very often get people to staff the polls, let's say, who are elderly, and then we bring in new technology and say, well, this is new this year. We're not going to give you a lot of training on it, but here are your new computer voting systems. Let's see what happens. Is your sense that there's a lot of that going on?
So poll worker error is a really big problem. So we have a volunteer system for our poll workers. They aren't trained particularly well, and particularly when you introduce new technology, you run into problems. So there are places where poll worker error has caused people just to lose the data, all the votes that were cast in a given computer. In Maryland, they had to open the polling places hours late because they just couldn't figure out how to get the machines online. You know, there's error built into the registration system because when people register to vote, that their data are entered incorrectly. So when they turn up thinking that they had properly registered, they discover that something's wrong with it and they can't cast a vote. I mean, just poll workers don't know about when to give provisional ballots. There's just one problem after another that can happen when you have poorly trained poll workers. And it's not their fault. I mean, these are people who are incredibly generously giving their entire day to help out with the election system. It's just that we, unlike every modern democracy, rely on volunteers and partisans to run our election system instead of professionals.
Yeah, you mentioned some amazing things. In 2006, there was a really hotly contested congressional race in Florida, and the winner was decided by 373 votes. So you think, oh my gosh, that's incredibly close. Except that they forgot to count 18,000 ballots.
If they didn't forget to count them, they just couldn't count them, which was perhaps even more nerve-wracking. I mean, I don't want to make anyone think that the whole system is falling apart. In a lot of ways, you know, what we see in our election system is what we see in our road system and our bridge system, which is deferred maintenance. And that means that most of the roads are safe and most of the bridges are safe, but because we're not paying enough attention to the election infrastructure that we have, there are some places that are just not able to handle the turnout tsunami that approaches during a hotly contested presidential election like the one coming up.
Now, you mentioned other countries. I'm really interested in that. How do other countries vote? How good is our process compared to their process? When you sort of look out at a broader landscape, and I bet most of us have no sense of how people vote in Australia or Japan or France. What's it like out there?
So the key difference between how we vote and how other countries vote, and I love sort of when I go to other countries and talk about our democracy, which is, you know, one of the most cherished democracies in the world, and people learn about how we actually run our election system. And the core difference is in other election systems, partisan officials are not the ones who are running the system. And you can see why that's the case, because it's very hard to ref the game at the same time you're playing the game. So that's just a basic core insight. I mean, I once talked to someone who did democracy reform work abroad. He was working for the U.S. government. And he said, you know, we wouldn't fund a government where partisan officials were the people who were running the system, because it's just a bad practice. The second key difference is that most of them have professionalized bureaucracies where they hire people and pay them money and train them and keep them insulated from the political process, and those are the folks that run the election system. And we rely on a highly decentralized system with lots of volunteers and partisans up and down the process. And again, you know, these are for the most part people who are doing a really tough job without adequate resources, but you just shouldn't create a system in which the people who are making the judgment calls when it's a close call are people with partisan affiliation.
Okay, so let's talk about your solution, which in some ways is like the U.S. News and World Report ranking of colleges, which so many people know about. So many people buy that issue of U.S. News and World Report to see where colleges rate and, you know, where their kids should be applying and that kind of thing. How do you apply that to voting systems to make voting systems better?
So it's a very simple idea. Right now, most people, when they propose reform, say, we have to reform the system from top to bottom. We have to pass a federal mandate. We have to create a federal bureaucracy. And that's all fine. It's just not going to happen anytime soon. So my proposal is to do something very simple, which is to create a U.S. News and World Report-like ranking for how well the election system is run. So it would basically put together data on the election system for everyday voters about how the states are doing. Because right now, no one has any idea whether their state is a well-run system or not. No one has any idea whether the state next door is doing better or worse. And the point behind it is very simple. We often talk about the states as laboratories of democracy, and they are. The key is, in the election process, we are not paying attention to the results from the experiments. And so all a democracy index would do is record the results from the experiment and give us a sense of what's working and and what's not.
So it, much in the same way you might have a college that's ranked number 15 on U.S. News and World Report, and 2 years later it's ranked 25, and people start saying, well, what happened to our school? Can you get it back up? Have we, you know, relaxed our standards? Your sense is that maybe then there would be pressure if your state is ranked, you know, 39 out of 50 to get that state higher on the democracy index.
I know how there will be pressure because I've seen how these rankings work in other areas. So let me just give you one really great example. In the environmental context, there's always been a lot of debate about whether countries are doing well on the environmental front or not, and reformers inside the countries really struggle to convince people if they don't think a good job is being done. So in Belgium, for example, environmentalists were constantly telling the government that they weren't doing a good job, and the government was saying they were doing a great job, and no one could really referee that debate. No one really had a way of measuring it. But a group of scientists and social scientists at Columbia and Yale put together an environmental performance index. And lo and behold, what the Belgians discovered was that while all the other European countries were near the top of that ranking, Belgium was down with Trinidad Tobago. It was way, way down on the rankings with a bunch of countries that were far poorer and less resource rich and less conscious about these kinds of questions than Belgium. And the result was some series of substantial reform because Belgium wanted to be ranked with its peers. It didn't want to be ranked with countries where they expected them to perform worse.
Right, right. And we've seen people talk about that, too, with the U.S. Our infant mortality is around that of Cuba, and I've heard people express sort of shock at that. But like you said, you need data to actually assess where you are, where you fall.
Exactly. And one of the things that I've learned, actually, in talking to election administrators across the country is they care deeply about these questions. This is one of the funny things that people forget about peer pressure. So peer pressure produces a lot of stupid things, you know, tongue rings and chia pets and Britney Spears and Justin Bieber. However, peer pressure also produces a desire to do well in the eyes of your peers. And election administrators are just like everyone else. They want to do well in the eyes of their peers. And so what's interesting is you put a bunch of data up, and every election administrator in the room will be silent because they want to know where they are and where they rank and why they rank there and how they can do better. So they care more deeply about those rankings than probably anybody else. And so it's just their own desire to do a good job that will make the index matter.
Well, so then what do you rank? Because certainly with U.S. News and World Report, they've come under some fire for, okay, maybe you're ranking the wrong things when it comes to evaluating which colleges are better than which other colleges.
With regard to that question, I think the way that you have to understand it is as opposed to what, which is the political science question that they always ask. And so the question is, when you look at the U.S. News World Report rankings, it's not perfect. No ranking is ever perfect. But you have to wonder as opposed to what. And so let me just give you an example. If people don't have rankings like these, they just tend to rely on reputation. And so, for example, I'm at a law school. It turns out that if you just did a survey of people that about ranking law schools, they tell you that Princeton University has the third or fourth best law school in the country. Now, of course, Princeton University doesn't have a law school. But people just sort of assume it's kind of prestigious. It must have a pretty good law school. And they don't really have much by way of judging this. So the U.S. News and World Reports is not perfect. There may be better rankings out there, but it's a useful baseline to begin the conversation. And so, too, the hope with the Democracy Index would be not to suggest that we have a perfect index, not to suggest that it can't be made better, but to find a set of data that are good enough to start the conversation and start thinking about, okay, how would we really measure election performance if we wanted to perfection and to work toward that?
And what are some of the things that you think would be good to put into that index?
Well, so that we have a huge dilemma in this country, which is we know more about our baseball teams. We know more about the dishwashers, thanks to Consumer Reports. We know more about the corporations we invest in, God help us, than we do about how well our election system is run. So when you start to dig underneath it, you learn that a lot of the data that we really ought to have, we don't have because nobody is recording the results of the 50-state-wide experiment that we're doing. But there is some data out there. So, for example, we have some numbers about what are called ballot discard rates. It's a very simple metric invented by a political scientist at MIT Caltech, and it measures something very easy, which is when you put ballots into a machine, how many of them get counted? Now, why is that number important? Because if it turns out the machine is discarding a lot more ballots than every other machine in the country, it's probably a bad machine. It's not the voters. it's the machine. So one of the numbers we have is that rate, the amount of ballots that get rolled off a machine. And that's a really good measure, and we can compare across jurisdictions to get a sense of how people are doing. We have measurements on turnout rates and registration rates across the country, which are roughly comparable. And again, that might be a pretty good metric for thinking about whether or not a system is doing a good job of turning out and registering voters.
So let's talk about where the Democracy Index is going, where you see it going. I know it's gotten a close look from both President Obama and from Secretary of State now, Hillary Clinton. She looked at it when she was senator. They've both sort of been interested in it. Do you get a sense that it may gain some traction and become like the U.S. News and World Report college rankings?
Yeah, so when I first put this idea into a little 700-word editorial, within just a couple of months, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, both then senators, had put it into pending separate legislation. And I thought, this is great. Two of the most important senators in the country have picked up this idea. It's sure to happen. And then, without any thought for how it affected my research agenda, they both decided to run against one another for the presidency. So that was the end of their bills. But Congressman Steve Israel has been working very hard inside of on the Hill to push this through, and a foundation, the Pew Center in the States, has put a huge amount of money and resources into thinking about these kinds of questions and moving it forward. So the Pew Center in the States is actually, some point after the election, going to put out the first prototype of this, which is a really remarkable thing, because I will just tell you, to be frank, I thought without a federal mandate for the data that we wouldn't be able to put together enough data for this in a serious way. But the thing that's so remarkable about the Pew Center in the States is that they are a place that cares about state government, they care about data-driven analysis, and they are the most rigorous and impressive foundation you can imagine in terms of working on these things. And so they're working right now to put it together, and I think at some point after the election we may see the first prototype of it.
That'll be really interesting to see the list come out. So let's talk about the election that is almost upon us in a few days. I wonder, when you heard that Hurricane Sandy was coming and you saw that early voting was being suspended in a number of states, what went through your mind?
Well, you know, usually the election administrator's prayer is, please, God, let this election not be close. But now I think we have to add one and let there not be a giant hurricane right beforehand. So, you know, the states are trying to figure out what to do going forward. It is a real problem when early voting opportunities are cut down. Early voting has been one of the great blessings of the last few years, and the reason is very simple. It's incredibly hard, as one election administrator told me, to have everybody show up at your wedding. You know, imagine an election administrator's day on Tuesday. It means that everybody comes and in a very short time and casts a vote. Early voting is a strategy for relieving the pressure on election administrators on election day. It means you can smooth out the days, smooth out the lines. You'd have more capacity. So early voting has made a big difference in the way that we run our election system, and it's made it easier not to have a crisis on election day. So when we lose chances for early voting, we increase the pressure that happens on Tuesday, we increase the likelihood of lines, and we increase the likelihood of a problem.
We've also heard so much in the last few weeks and months about the issue of voter fraud, which itself has been hotly contested. And then, okay, if there is an issue of voter fraud, do we require more from people who show up to vote in terms of IDs? This is obviously, as you know, as a law professor, been litigated through many courts. What's your sense of the impact of that debate on Tuesday's election?
You know, I don't think we really know what the numbers are going to look like, and I'm not sure if we, and the reason is simple, is because a lot of the voter ID laws that got passed have been struck down by the courts or modified by the courts. So we don't yet have a full sense of what the impact's going to be like, and that's in part, again, because we haven't had particularly good data to measure these things in the past. But I will just say that my friend and colleague, Nate Persily, describes the voter ID rule as a solution chasing after a non-existent problem. And the reason is just simple. If you just imagine you wanted to steal an election, probably the last way that you would do it is by having in-person fraud, because you'd have to get a bunch of people on a bus, and you'd have to go from polling place and have them give fake names and hope that not a single polling worker happened to know that Joe Smith died 3 weeks ago. And then you'd have to hope that the 50 people in your giant conspiracy don't breathe a word of it. Or you could do what every other person who steals an election tries to do, which is think about absentee ballots or something like that. There's just so little evidence that in-person fraud is the source of fraud in this country. If I had my druthers, I'd rather see people focus on the real security issues in the election system and not on in-person fraud, which, as far as we know, and every respected social scientist has concluded over and over again, is not a problem. And, you know, when you're in politics long enough, you start to worry when people start passing laws to fix non-existent problems, particularly if it seems likely to help one party rather than another.
Let me focus on another issue that may bring fraud into it or may be completely not malicious but still problematic, our technology. You say our technology is way behind. We heard that clip from Florida at the beginning of the segment, and we all remember the hanging chads. Obviously, we have this patchwork of optical scans and provisional ballots and all this stuff going on. What's your sense of where our technology is? Is it as good as it needs to be? Is there a gold standard in technology? What's going on with election technology?
So the kinds of machines we're using in 2000 were basically sort of in the horse and buggy days kind of machines. And the one, it's true that we use a lot of different machines now, and it's true that they're not all perfect, far from it. But they're a lot better than they used to be, and we can tell that because we actually have data on it. And so we can tell that the machines are doing a much better job than they used to be doing. But there's still a ton of work to do. For example, the registration process is still almost antiquated by comparison to what is used in other countries. So I would just say on the technology front, these things are related. So one of the reasons why our tech isn't very good is because our system is so decentralized. There's lots and lots of benefits with decentralization, lots of reasons to allow for local power. But in terms of buying the machines and the technology, the reason why we don't get very good machines is because there's so little money to be made. You know, Diebold, for example, which makes election machines, it also makes ATM machines. It knows how to make a really good, secure machine, but there's no money in elections because the buys are so small and because there's so little opportunity for making decent money on it. Other countries, for example, when they do this, they do it in a centralized way, and so they get much bigger bids and they get much better bids on their machinery.
And is having better tech drive up turnout? I mean, I know many other countries have higher turnout than we do. Is that because people believe, yes, for sure, my vote's going to be counted?
You know, it's so very hard to measure that. The participation in other countries is higher than ours for lots of different reasons. And so you should always be cautious when election reformers tell you they've got the silver bullet. I will just say, though, that technology would make our registration system work better than it is right now. And the registration system is a cause of a lot of the problems that we see. It's hard to register. A lot of times there are a lot of errors in the registration process, and those errors lead to a lot of voters showing up on election day finding out that they have to cast a provisional ballot because they're not in the system. And that's where a streamlined high-tech system would be helpful.
And one final question. You know, we were talking before about how this solution came from you, sort of came from outside of the halls of politics. And you talk in the book about a new generation embracing a kind of venture capitalist approach, a sort of whatever works approach to even things like government. Do you see a change in the way that we look for innovative solutions now, whether it's inside or outside of government?
Yeah, you really see it in terms of the new style of reform, election reform is a little bit later to the game than other areas, but the new reformer is not a starry-eyed idealist. The new reformer is someone who can run tech, who understands data-driven analysis, and who's extremely pragmatic. And I think that's all to the good, because what we need right now is not so much starry-eyed idealists, it's just people willing to roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty and figure out what works and what doesn't.
We've been looking at what it would take to turn our broken election system into a well-oiled machine. And I've been speaking with Heather Gerken. She's the J. Skelly Wright Professor at Yale Law School, where she teaches election and constitutional law. And she's also the author of The Democracy Index. Heather Gerken, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And next up, we stick with politics and ask two leaders in the field, what role does government play in innovation? And should we be worried that governments in other parts of the world, China and India, for example, are pulling ahead when it comes to new technologies and great education?
China is definitely investing a lot more in the so-called STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And we are falling behind. We are falling behind, and over the long term, that is going to hurt us.
Remember that you can subscribe to our podcasts and get more information about our guests at wgbh.org/innovationhub. And you can also follow us on Twitter at @WGBHInnovate. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.